Hey, Bill, how you doing?
I'm pretty good, Pat. We have got a really exciting episode this week on the Airgun Geeks podcast, and I am delighted to bring two absolute rock stars onto the podcast who are going to give us some really groundbreaking information, what's going on with hunting in 2024, specifically as it applies to air guns. So I'm really, really stoked.
Yeah, same here.
How are things going down there in Florida? I hear you broke your boat already, and you haven't even gotten paid on that thing yet.
Yeah, well, you know, it's all part of the break-in process.
You took it seriously. I'm going to break this freaking thing.
Well, you know, you got to might as well break it now before someone gets on there. But no, I'm getting ready. It's starting to get hot and muggy down here. Not that I'm complaining. Getting to see the iguanas everywhere. And while I was breaking in my boat, I found iguanas up here in Port St. Lucie. I'm like, okay, we got them close. So I got excited and got people starting to call me now saying, hey, we got the iguanas in the swimming pool.
It's been kind of chilly up there, so maybe it just took them a while to get there because they're cold blooded. Just took them a while to
little by little. It has been chilly. It has been chilly up here, Florida wise.
Yeah.
So yeah, the rest of the world now they're freezing.
70 is freezing in Florida, right?
Yeah, 70s like the board generally 72. You start seeing snow pants at 70, 69.
Yeah. I get it.
Not as bad as you Californians.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick capitalism break here and then bring in our amazing panel of guests that we have today. So let's thank our sponsors. Hello, fans. We're taking a brief moment to recognize and show our appreciation for the incredible support of our sponsors. Their commitment not only fuels our content, but also ensures we can bring you the very best of the airgun world. Firstly, a huge shout out to Southern Precision Air Weapons. Ken is a master of hard-hitting airgun tunes that deliver unrivaled accuracy. Moving on, we extend our gratitude to High Pressure Pneumatics. Be sure to check out what Tom has going on at his store in Michigan and online as well. Let's not forget the remarkable contribution of Donnie FL. Their innovations in suppressors have revolutionized the experience in the field, combining stealth with performance. A special thanks to GX Compressors as well for their robust and efficient compressors that are an absolute game changer in the pneumatic technology and convenience. Be sure to check out Scout Air Guns for the Epic and the all-new Evo. JSB and Predator International for the finest in airgun projectiles. Affordable, well-made, and fun airgun products from Umarex Airguns. And lastly, we express our sincere appreciation for Saber Tactical. Their tactical gear is not only about strength and durability, it's about taking your airgun experience to the next level. We proudly stand alongside these titans of the airgun industry and invite you, our valued listeners, to explore their outstanding offerings. Supporting our sponsors is directly supporting the Airgun Geeks, enabling us to continue delivering you the content you love and trust. Thank you for being the most essential part of our journey. Your engagement and support make all of this possible. Until next time, stay tuned and keep supporting those who make the Airgun Geeks a reality.
Wow. Hey, I'm still impressed, Bill, that all these people still back us. It's absolutely awesome where we've come. I'm always amazed.
Yeah, I keep waiting for the pink slip, you know. I don't know. Hey, I don't want to spend too much time because these guests are they're getting awfully fidgety in the waiting room there. And you know, Chris doesn't do well when he's left to his own. He needs supervision. So let's go ahead and bring them in the studio. And it was interesting when I was at SHOT Show this year. There was a lot of scuttlebutt. There was a talk being given at SHOT 2024. And one of the topics they were talking about is the Pittman-Robertson Act and whether or not to include air guns in that. And for those that don't know, Chris is going to explain what that's all about and how it affects the air gunner. But that's only one small bit of what we're going to get to. I hope we can get all this into one episode. We may have to come back and do another one, Pat. I don't know.
Maybe. There's a lot here.
Let's bring them in.
All right.
There they are. Welcome to Rick Ream, Shooter 1721, and Chris Turek, the turret, up north air gunner.
Hey, welcome, guys.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having us.
Oh, no problem. Thanks. You two are very hard to get a hold of. You guys are some slippery fellows.
Yes. Yeah.
Well camouflaged.
You don't get that big. You don't get that big on YouTube by talking to the peons, Pat. I'm kidding.
No.
I'm kidding.
Come on.
Yeah, no.
Come on. We're just normal guys, right, Rick?
You are.
You got that right.
I'm normal. Rick is not technically human. He's definitely
yeah, I agree.
He's a Terminator.
Fair point. Fair point.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
All right. Well, hopefully you guys have been doing well. It's been a while since we've had you guys on the podcast. You guys are definitely aging well. So that's a positive here.
That's good.
And I packed on some pounds over the winter. I mean, since deer season, I probably gained about 10 pounds, but we'll see what happens going into the shooting season. I need to kind of drop some weight for competition for sure.
Yeah. We'll
maybe what you might consider, Chris, is maybe putting a tree stand like right next to your house. That way you can just go out and go up and down the tree stand, get your training in that way.
Perfect idea.
I would not tell him. Yeah. Guaranteed.
Yeah. You're going to get a letter by the wife there, Bill.
Guys, there's a funny story to that. When I got into tree saddle hunting, my wife thought I was ridiculous because I was had a tree saddle on. I'm in my front yard. Neighbors are driving by, and I'm like shimmying up the tree with my tree saddle. And they were like, what the heck are you doing down there? I'm practicing.
That's a true story, too. Mm-hmm.
I remember
he got a hold of me, and he says, what do you think? I'm like, oh, boy. When he's ready to hunt, you just let him go.
So Chris, you had some interesting thoughts, and I had shared some ideas that I had about this push to get the Pittman-Robertson Act extended into the air gun industry as a method of making local game organizations more willing to accept air gun hunting as a valid method of harvest. And, you know, you brought up some very interesting points when we first had that conversation about, you know, where does that end? Is it every air gun? Is it the CO2 pistol that'll never be used for hunting? And when you raised that argument, I got to thinking and I said, well, you know, how do they handle this in the firearms world? They don't. Do you pay that excise tax on every single firearm, even if it's a .22 pistol? Is that the same for them? Or is that what we're looking at? What is your perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really hard question. I mean, one of the things I think when we get into this conversation, I think a lot of people need to know exactly what is the Pittman-Robertson Act. And I think, you know, before we get into the nuances of how it applies to the air gun sector or the firearm sector, I mean, ultimately what it is, it's a federal excise tax that ultimately the cost is going to be passed on to the consumer because it's going to be taxed to the manufacturer. Then they're obviously going to pass it on to the consumer. So you're going to end up more than likely then paying that additional amount when you make purchases of gear. So right now, as we buy other gear and other hunting disciplines with firearms and such, you're already paying that. And that money then goes to conservation efforts. A lot of times that's given to, I believe, to states through different grant programs and different wildlife habitat rehabilitation programs. So for instance, here in Michigan, a lot of our turkey habitat, deer wintering places, it needs to have habitat basically betterment. So, you know, our game animals can flourish. So that's really where the money's supposed to go, how it's supposed to work. So I guess on paper, I'm pretty against taxation across the board. But, you know, technically on paper, it sounds like it's going to a good thing. But the problem with air guns, like you brought up when we did a little bit of a pregame around this conversation, is, well, how are you going to identify what type of air gun are you going to put that excise tax on? Because I've got my actually I got one right here. I promise I didn't put it there, but I've got one of these, and this I'm not going to be hunting deer or rabbits with.
No.
So, you know, I'm not going to pay a nice tax on that, but let's say like my Air Force Texan or one of my big boy air guns, I would. So there are states right now that have looked at creating a conservation stamp that you would actually purchase at the point of sale with buying your hunting license. I personally think that's probably the better way to handle this, because not all air gunners are going to want to hunt, right? They may want to just plink. So I'm a huge advocate for the conservation stamp that would be purchased at the point of purchase of your hunting license.
Yeah. So how does that jive with the firearms world? Are they going to be accepting of that? Like, you guys got an easy out, you got this stamp, and you don't have to play the same game we do, and we don't like it? Or how do you see that playing out?
You know, I don't think it's the manufacturers in the firearm sector that's going to raise the biggest stink. It's going to be the wildlife agencies, right? I mean, it's going to be the agencies that are the recipients of that money. I think they're going to – Rick, what do you think?
I agree with you. I mean, I actually, here in PA, we had that conversation, and I was told by certain people that, they're going to – at first, it was tried to pass it off that the gun manufacturers might be upset that air gunners not doing this, it could hurt, and that's what they were afraid of. But, Chris, as we move along, I think we're starting to see something different.
Yeah.
With the, you know what I mean, as far as the conservation, I think you're seeing more of that. I think, I know as I talked to the guys in PA, I was kind of like, well, guys, we talked about the stamp. That's been, 6 years I've been dealing with this and talking with them, Chris?
Yep.
You think?
Yeah. Yeah, it's 6 or 7 years you've been doing that. Because I know just the advocacy that I've been doing here in Michigan is pushing 5 or 6 years, and Rick's been doing it longer than I have. So,
wow.
Yeah, so I just know in some of the states that I've talked with, we've done a couple basically demonstration range days here in Michigan, where we had all of the chiefs of wildlife agencies from the entire Midwest, to include like Iowa, Wisconsin, a lot of states would came up here to Michigan. And we did another one up a couple years ago with both the wildlife agencies and then also a group of outdoor writers. And to be honest, the excise question didn't come up as much as, which is another rabbit hole for us to discuss, is that I think other hunting groups would often stand in the way of air gun legislation or regulation to allow during a hunting season. A lot of times it was a bit of a protectionist approach on their part to ensure like their time in the woods was not being, you know, affected or threatened by the air gun sector. So, you know, I think sometimes that excise tax, you know, behind closed doors with wildlife agencies, it is a real issue. But whenever you are hearing, just for example, let's say the Archery Trade Association or archers coming into the argument, a lot of the times it's more of protectionism, a little bit of keeping air gunners out of their seasons.
Yeah. Yep.
Do you think it's what component of that not in my backyard philosophy do you see? Like in the case of archers, I mean, I've seen this. I was a member of an archery club here in California. I love archery. I do trad archery. And I was, you know, they had an issue in their clubhouse with rodents. And I said, you know, I can come down here in an evening and cut your rodent population in half quickly. And when I told them, you know, it was with an air gun, they were like, oh no, you can't have an air gun here. I'm like, I can, there's something legally preventing me, but what am I supposed to come down here and trash my arrows trying to shoot at concrete floors for rats? It doesn't make sense. So I don't get it. I don't understand where that mentality comes from. The not in my backyard mentality. What do you see?
Yeah, I'm an archery hunter myself. I mean, my very first hunting season as a deer hunter here in Michigan was with a bear archery recurve. And I think that thing might've been pushing maybe 35 pounds or something like that. It was, you know, just barely legal, but I was, I think maybe 14. I can't remember exactly, maybe 13. And I get it. I mean, my dad, he would not allow me to go into the woods until I think it was at either 15 yards. It was like one of those little pie plates, you know, those little dessert pie plates, those paper ones. Mm-hmm. Put it up on the straw bale, and he would not let me even get my license until I could put 5 arrows into that plate. And so it takes a lot of practice, like a ton of practice for archers to be proficient in that craft. And I think, you know, those that I identify as being archers, it's, and that's it, like nothing else. I can see where they would feel like they've earned that level of, you know, aptitude and skill to basically go into the woods. And I mean, shoot my crossbow over there, I can throw on an Element Optic scope and be ready to go within 3 shots, right? And within 15 minutes, I can go to the woods and I know I can be ethical and efficient, probably out to 50 yards with a crossbow. And so I think for them, they see it as it's kind of threatening all the hard work that they've put into their craft. And I understand that, but also I'm about freedom. And the way I look at it is that, you know, if you have your own private land, we're talking about public land, right? When we pass like hunting regulations and things like that, it's like, that's our freedoms should not be infringed upon. And as I get older, I mean, I just turned 48. It's getting really hard for me to draw a vertical bow. I'll be honest. I mean, I've got this brand new bow that's got like a 98% let off, but it's still getting hard to get over that, you know, to get over that hump. And I know when I'm like in my 60s and 70s, I would love to use an arrow gun, but I know that's probably never going to be possible here in Michigan. So I'll probably end up traveling to other states. So Rick, I don't know what your thoughts on some of that are.
Me, you know, same way, Chris, I had a Jennings Lightning, and that was the first time I went deer hunting was with a bow. Mm-hmm. And I just remember as a kid, my dad did the same thing, you know, except my dad was a little bit, he wasn't a pie plate, it was actually a playing card. Just kidding.
Edgewise, right, Rick? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had to do it with a knife, too, just in case you guys were wondering. But anyway, now, I'm okay, like, with if you talk about, you know, in the backyard. I remember this. I did a Hershey show, Kinsey's Archery. And it was the first year of the Benjamin Airbow. Holy cow. I'm in with the rest of the crossbow guys. Now, let's play this through. Traditional archers, crossbow. These guys are idiots, you know? You can't crossbow. So now I'm in with the crossbows, and they're like, you can't use an air gun. That's stupid. And I'm like, the hate just went right down the line. You can't be in here with me. And true story, I do want to tell the story, Chris, because this is a good one. The guy from Barnett Crossbows, Guy Crossbows, walks over to me, and he says, so you think that thing's accurate, huh? And I went, you know. He says, he takes his Barnett crossbow and shoots my target and dead bullseye nails it. And he says, beat that. And he had 20, 30 people there. And I went, okay. What you saw was the Benjamin Airbow arrow. You didn't see his arrow no more. We couldn't figure out what happened to it. I still have it in the gun room. I have to break that out for you guys. I Robin Hood his arrow for him. We're friends to this day. That man still messages me and goes, that was one of the best things I've ever seen. And that kind of broke because I was just having fun with it. But he kind of was like, oh, okay, they are accurate. And I was like,
is that winning an argument, just, Rick Ream style?
That was.
I think so, 100%.
Yeah. And I
he does it all. Yeah, he gets me to shut up quite often by basically doing stuff like dueling trees, 100-yard shots. I talk a lot of trash, but Rick quiets me down pretty quick.
Yeah. I remember Chris said to me one time, he goes, can I just shoot my gun in? He says, when I shoot with you, Rick, it's like, hey, you see that rock out there, 400? Watch this. You see that dandelion over there? Watch this. You know, because I just want to – for me, the air gun is to have fun, of course, to hunt and have a good time.
Yep.
But in all seriousness, though, when it comes to the people in the, you know, in the backyard, as far as them, you know, being upset here in PA, I'm starting a movement of people intrigued. So after 6 or 7 years, Chris, I know you've been grinding there, too, but people are more like, wait, it can do what? And it can, mm-hmm. how far? You know, and that's why I put the videos out there. Of course, they're silly, you know, where you're like airbow 200 yards, watch it balloon. But the capabilities of the guns, you're now seeing that. You're seeing what the capability of the accuracy, just like a crossbow. And I think education is our biggest thing, Chris, is keep educating, making videos, draw attention, and then get the people to talk to us. And then when they do, like, oh, I didn't know that. So
I just I want to say one more thing about this, because I know we have other things we want to talk about. But, man, this is a rabbit hole. Trust me. I mean, to Rick's point is – it's not, as a matter of fact, it's actually probably a detriment. They're so good because one of the biggest arguments that I have gotten from just other wildlife agencies, other hunters that, you know, want to go against this within their state is they start bringing up the concept of it's going to decimate the, you know, the deer population, right? It's going to basically wipe them out. And so what's interesting, like, you know, Rick and I have been going back and forth about this. I currently hold this record of hitting a golf ball at 150 yards with an arrow air gun. I know Rick has probably already beat it and just hasn't published the video. But when I published that video, they actually showed it at one of the agency demonstrations that I was talking about. And then, oh my gosh, you thought people, it's not about the ethical nature of it. They know it's ethical. They know it has, you know, lethality, killing power, precision, but that's what freaks them out because they're like, oh my gosh, this is going to, you know, decimate the deer herd. What's interesting though, is that you look at, like, I think a lot of people get confused about why there are hunting seasons. They think it's for black powder. They think it's for archery. They think it's for rifle. It's not, it's actually for conservation. It's basically to make sure that they have X number of animals that need to be harvested every year to keep everything in balance, both biologically. And then also here in Michigan, we have over 50 to 60,000 deer vehicle accidents a year. So our insurance rates go up, right? Mm-hmm. So in essence, when you look at hunting seasons, there really shouldn't be a archery season or a rifle season or whatever. It's about conservation. How can we keep that herd in check? And so, I mean, if you look at here in Michigan, our deer harvest last year was down 10%. And guess what? Our crossbow utilization went from 30% like 5 years ago up to 75% of all archers now are using crossbow.
Oh, I didn't. Wow.
And our deer harvest went down 10%. So whenever I hear that argument of like, oh my gosh, we need to like air bows and, you know, air guns would decimate the deer herd population, the hunter decline is it's still happening so rapid that it's basically offsetting any additional deer that were harvested because of a more lethal weapon.
And I think that's a great answer. And I think that's a nuance that we need to bring to light too, is the fact that, you know, even in areas where hunting is a lot more popular than it is here in California. I mean, you guys live, I lived in Pennsylvania. I lived right down the road from Rick. I hunted in Pennsylvania. It's a big hunting state. In fact, for years, the town that I lived in, opening day was a holiday for schools. Schools didn't go to school.
Right.
You didn't have school on opening day. You went out with your dad. And that is in decline. The amount of hunters going out in the field is in decline. So how do we increase the efficacy of the hunt and continue to manage those numbers and keep the animals healthy? What the people who are anti-hunting don't want to admit is how Mother Nature takes care of herds that get too big. And it's horrible. The diseases that end up infiltrating those herds is absolutely devastating. And it is a really a terrible way to go. And, you know, taking an animal ethically and humanely is the way to solve that problem. And why wouldn't you want the best tools that you are comfortable using? If you're not comfortable using an air bow, don't use one. But don't tell me I can't, because I know I can take that animal and harvest it and have it for lunch all through the winter. Why not let me do that?
Right on.
Yep. And I think that is a great segue to go from arrows to slinging lead. And the one thing that we were chatting about was big bores. Mm-hmm. My God, the calibers that have come out. I'm like,
95 caliber. I saw 95 at EWA.
You know, we're at huge angles and all. I'm like, why are we so big? We don't need a 3,500 millimeter. You know, what are we doing? You know, when I saw you shooting that one deer with the 72 caliber Zeus, I was like, I shot that. I'm like, oh my God. Yeah. I personally like the 45 caliber, the extra 45.
That's a good caliber.
Personally.
Yeah.
And you're, I tell people I like 60, 70 yards max, trying to get them closer. Will it do 100? If you're Rick Rem shooting stuff, having fun. Yeah. But you're still, the projectile is traveling slower than the sound. You're going to get them to jump. They're either going to go up, down, or all around, and you're going to miss or wound. And now you're chasing. Yeah. So I'll start with you, Chris, because I see you shooting a lot with the big boars hunting. Where are you feeling with big boars and where we're at?
Man, I'll tell you, I carried around that 72 cal Zeus for an entire deer season a couple years. And that, I mean, like you saw in the video, it will do some damage when it hits. But how big boar air guns get those foot-pounds of energy is through length of barrel. I mean, I think a lot of times people like to have a smaller barrel, but even whenever you're up at 300 bar, 4,500 PSI, when you're making those barrels shorter, you're just giving up energy. So for the reason when and I've actually switched a little bit here recently with the Texan carbine, but if you want to go for big power, you got to have that long barrel. You got a long barrel, that thing's going to be super heavy. And it was not a fun air gun to carry around the woods. Carried around both the 58 cal and the 72 cal Zeus for a while. You know, it's great. I mean, on paper, huge numbers. You know, now we've got here at, you know, a SHOT Show, we've seen was at the 92 cal, you know, come out. And, you know, here's the thing, guys, you know, I'm at dozens of deer. I've lost count. I've killed dozens of deer at this point. And I've actually gone down. Rick actually sent me his 4.57 carbine this year. I had used the 50 cal carbine last year. And I really just wanted to, hey, like, how much do we actually need here? And Rick sent me his 4.57 carbine. You're not getting it back, by the way. And and I dropped that deer. And that deer the last 3 years with those Texan carbines, I have shot three deer with the 50 twice and that 4.57 once. And they have taken that many steps, zero steps. It's all about shot placement. And I was using the Neil Tressler fireballs, and I think they're maybe, I was like in that 400 foot-pounds of energy, maybe 500 foot-pounds of energy. And I've come to the realization, you just got to really know what your ammunition is doing once it hits meat. And those FPE numbers actually can be pretty deceiving. I've done a lot of ballistics gel testing. Rick and I geek out on this stuff on the phone all the time. And I call Rick, hey, Rick. Hey man, do you see these 500 grain, 72 cal things look like flying ashtrays, but they hit the gel and they turn into a dollar, but they only go in like 8 inches. I'm like, but that's a whole huge FPE number, but they're not getting the penetration. And that's what is going to harvest and dispatch that deer is getting through both of those lungs. So these big calibers with big FPE numbers, at the end of the day, you got to know what that slug is doing when it hits venison, basically.
Right. I know for myself, the Texan carbine, we took the Black Bear with the 457, and then I took a Aldad in Texas out 73 yards, and after I watched it, it was an episode for American Air Gunner. After we took the shot and I watched the film back, that round passed through, Chris, with that Nielsen 388 grain, passed through, and that was it. It ran 29 yards. It fell over. And I remember the guy was getting so excited. He's like, you got to reload. You got to reload. I said, that's a dead man walking right there. That shot placement went right through both lungs and the heart. Yep. And I remember looking over at him, they were so excited. And I was like, trust me, he's dead. And we walked to the cliff, the edge of a cliff, because he was down below. Down over, he's laying there with his tongue out. And I'm like,
yeah.
So I've seen the bear went 10 yards and it was it.
Yeah.
So I've seen, you know, and, you know, I've seen what we can do with something like that. So I was, you know, there's two big game animals, and then the deer I shot was with pile driver 62 and 30 yards, and that was it. So
yeah,
Yeah,
I have had a chance to shoot Chad Simon's 20 millimeter. Chad Simon from Lethal Air. I've shot his 20 millimeter a couple times. You know, it's a big slug. You can see, you physically see it going down range, you know, 600-700 feet per second or something like that. And I mean, Rick and I talked a lot about
it. You can see it.
Yeah. And I honestly think we're both at a point right now as a really good 457 50 cal is really good. That, mm-hmm. You know, but again, and that Zeus 58 cal and that pile driver 62 cal, it's just it is a beast. So for me, it depends mm-hmm. on what kind of hunting I do. I am stalking a lot. I am moving around a lot. The guys at deer camp, if you're watching this, they absolutely hate how much I move around at deer camp. They actually tease me all the time that I got ADHD. I can sit for like maybe a half an hour after dawn. And then I'm like spotting and stalking. And they're like, freaking stay where you're at, man. Quit walking around. Yeah. So for me, it's like, I'm doing that kind of hunting. I love that Texan carbine, but if you are going to be sitting up in the blind,
can't beat it.
But if you're in a blind all day long set up on a tripod or something like that, you know, you can go with that pile driver 62 cal, because man, that thing is a absolute beast. But I don't know. You don't need it. I guess that's what I'm trying to say is these bigger calibers, bigger FPE numbers, you don't need it. And to be honest, even though I did a video that one time, I shot that deer at 160 yards. I had been practicing all summer long. I mean, I had that gun completely perfectly doped. But most people don't put in the trigger time that Rick and I do over like a summertime where we're constantly out there shooting. And I always tell people, keep it 100 yards and in. There's no reason for it. So,
yeah. All the videos we've ever put on YouTube, I said, hey, you know, let's stay at 50 to 60 yards. Let's stay ethical. And let's not have anything wounded. You know, I think I actually say that in a couple of the videos. It's kind of, you know, could I shoot one at 200 and put that round in it? Oh yeah. But don't know, you know, like Patrick said, you know, you don't know for sure. And I'm not willing to take it and, you know, with it but after Chris did his video, I was like, man, that was over, Chris. And I thought, you know, and you have full penetration, right? Didn't it go out the other side?
It basically bedded into
the side. That's right.
Yeah,
that's
but it was, right. I mean, full mushroom. And actually, it entered through the liver and bedded up in the backside shoulder.
That's
with the
right.
Mr. And, but, yeah. I mean, but would I take a lot of 160-yard shots like that? Not with a Texan carbine, maybe with a full-length Texan if I had practiced a lot. You know, a lot of the things about like with laser rangefighter technology, you don't have a lot of time to sit there and be ranging.
Right.
Here in Michigan, man, I actually am going to be producing a video here pretty soon. I got pinned by a doe. She came in at 100 yards and she knew exactly where I was the second she walked into that field. And if I even moved my hand a little bit at all, she was gone. So, you know, being able to range to that target once you get beyond 100 yards, it's pretty critical. Mm-hmm. I know Element Optics is coming out with some really cool new laser range finders you can actually just hit a button right there and it'll tell you, it'll actually give you a readout. So the Hyper 7 that I've got, that new laser range finder module they've got right there, you put it on your 4N stock, you hit the button. I mean, in the Hyper 7, it actually will move your reticle to where your point of aim should be, which is
That is crazy, yeah.
So something like that, once I test it, I trust it. I know it's, you know, you can repeat it. I would do it. But once you get beyond 100 yards, man, you better know within five yards where that animal is standing. And if they move, the trajectory on those slugs is just like a rainbow, man. So if they move another 10 yards, you are now out of the vital zone sometimes. Mm.
Now, you two guys.
I mean,
Go ahead, Rick. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, Chris owns the record for smashing a golf ball, those exploding golf balls at, 600 yards or something stupid? And I'm thinking about it, and I'm thinking, you know, why? Because that means he put the time in to figure the distance over and over and over. And he progressed from there, so he was starting at 150, 200, 300, 400, and then 500. And then he gets out to 600. And I'm like, that's a long way to stay accurate to hit something that, you know, this, you know, so that's a lot of work. And the reason I wanted to say about, you know, Chris's 160 yard shot, he puts the time in to understand his guns and stuff and the rounds. And after you do all the work with it and you put the time in, you can feel really confident about your shots. I know Chris, the Texan carbine, I mean, for walking around, I was elk hunting in Texas and we walked around for, I don't know, 8-9 hours the one day. And I didn't even feel like I had a gun in my hands. So
it's so light. Yeah. It's, I mean, I'm actually trying to do it right now. I'm trying to get this, the best big bores of 2024 video done. Problem is they keep coming out with some cool new ones and we'll talk about the new Serpent shotgun that just came out. Boy, whew. Anyway, so
I mean, we'll get
the Texan carbine for me has become just that ultimate deer hunting rifle. Cause most of my hunting, I'm 100 yards and in all the time in Michigan. Yeah. I'm hunting swamp edges. I'm hunting, you know, edges of a thick cover. I'm not going to be on the edge of a bean field or a you know, a plowed cornfield typically. And if I was, I would probably be using a full length Texan. So, but man, there's a lot of great big bore air guns out there. I mean, you really can't go wrong with a lot of them. They keep coming out with some cool ones, and turkey season is in less than a month.
Mm-hmm.
There's some cool shotgun stuff coming out. So let's maybe talk a little bit about that.
And what I wanted to, what we've always said here on the podcast is, if you could put it where you're aiming, it doesn't matter the caliber. But when you're lobbing these big projectiles, you got to look at the trajectory.
Right.
Because now you're going in from the top of the animal down, and there's a lot that goes into that. Plus, you know, sound is traveling faster than our projectiles. Yeah. So that goes into knowing all that. But shotguns. I've been saying that for a while. I would love a good shotgun. And all I'm finding is, I'm going to call it toys. Nothing that I would ethically take out, you know, something for American air gunner to shoot the, you know, clay pigeons in a competition, but to go bird hunting or something or squirrel. Where are you guys at on that?
You go first.
Well,
on this.
Chris. Yeah. So one gun that I've been waiting on for a while from Umarex is the Primal. And from what I'm hearing, and what, there's another gun just not exactly like it, but I think the same person, Chris, am I right, makes the gun, basically.
I think so.
But I actually saw somebody shoot a crow with one at 40 yards and blast him out of the sky. And I went, crows are tough. And he took him out. And I was like, lined up a pheasant hunt that we're going to take. We're going to be able to take the Primal on a pheasant hunt and go to the location. And hopefully let's show everyone what it can do. But when it comes to shotguns, this the Serpent, I don't know that much about that. Chris, that'd be more, you looked into that a little bit. Yeah. I know. All I know is I was excited to see the Primal because you can do both with the Primal. You can shoot a slug and the shotgun. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
that's I can't wait to get some hunts. Yeah,
I know. Right? It's like every year, right about now, it's about March, I just start getting turkey fever, and Rick messes with me every single year because he's got turkeys that go right through the shooter 17-21 range. And I mean,
I have the same problem.
Yeah, it's like I get turkey fever. Abby Casey actually just posted it, like when she was drinking coffee and she had some gobblers out there, and we were going back and forth about just like you get just obsessed with turkey hunting. And so for me, when I say air gun shotguns, for me specifically, it's about turkey. I really want to have like a really great tool to use. And Umarex, you know, we saw the one that came out at SHOT Show, I think it was like last year, the Primal. Super excited about that. I know they're still working some things out. That's going to be pretty awesome. You know, Terry Tate came out with the PBBA shotgun years ago. You know, with the I've been a huge advocate. And again, I know that every manufacturer is kind of going their own way of, you know, this is basically the problem, right? Trying to get something where you can get, you know, an ounce or more of shot, or maybe 3/4 of an ounce of shot into something. Most big bore air guns just do not have a breech to be able to fit something like that in it. So you almost have to have like a purpose built gun to be able to figure out this problem here. And so Umarex has done it. Terry Tate did it with the PBBA. And then also we've got like the wing shot. I actually took a turkey with the wing shot and the American Air Gunner episode a couple years ago with that. That was cool.
Yeah.
Problem with that is you actually had to double load those little capsules, or what I actually ended up doing was using like earplug foam. I would shove piece in there. And so I promise you, I don't have all these props here, but I just happen to have tungsten super shot. I can't show you my desk because like all my turkey hunting stuff is like right here. But like tungsten super shot, I would put that in there and then put another piece of foam behind it. And I dropped that turkey at 25 yards or whatever that was. It was great.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
That Serpent shotgun that just got announced. What is so cool about that is I call it a wad, but it is kind of a shell. They have a patent pending shell that they came up with. I promise you guys, I'm not intentionally having all of these. I got more props here, but this is the federal flight control wad. And in the firearm sector, these things right here are just, these are like magic, man. You can get things to pattern like this at 30 yards with these things. So Serpent came out with, and this is a patented thing that Federal came out with years ago for shotguns.
That's why you cut all those shells open.
Yeah. Yeah. So I actually bought a box 20 gauge. Actually, I've been just completely, all my props, I've been like cutting them up to harvest these out of them to put them into the Terry Tate PBA shotgun shell. But anyway, but Serpent came out with their own proprietary version of this thing. Man, I've been talking to the Michigan Air Gunner. Dude, he has been shooting that thing, and he's getting some pretty sweet groups at 30 yards with tungsten.
I did see that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I am super excited to get my hands on one of those things, because I think that is, for me, going to be the it turkey shotgun on the market. But I can't wait to see what Umarex comes out with. But yeah, I mean, I've done a ton of testing with tungsten. This stuff right here, guys, that's $100 of a shot, by the way.
Yeah.
It is not cheap. But basically turns your air gun into having the sectional density of this shot to basically perform like a 410 to 20 gauge shotgun firearm, which is awesome. So, yeah, man, I'm super excited to check out that Serpent. It's going to be sweet.
Chris, don't you agree that turkey hunting is one of the most peaceful things you can do? It's almost like you could sleep and just shoot it. You know what I mean?
Shut up. All right. So Rick sends me a picture. We've probably told a story on another podcast already, but we'll tell it on this one. So he goes out there. He was in Colorado. I can't remember where you were.
It was. And,
Freddie Hartice's ranch. Freddie Hartice from the Maverick TV show. And I had just, I don't know, I think I might have traveled something like 1,500 miles over 30 days. Didn't get a single shot on a turkey. Rick goes out there with his baseball hat, T-shirt, jeans, went and bought a shotgun at Walmart. And took a nap, fell asleep.
True story.
Woke up and dropped a Tom that had a beard like that big. And he's like, this isn't hard.
Yeah.
What are y'all complaining about? I was doing while he was sleeping.
Yeah. Well, I woke up and I saw, true story. It was a 10 hour. I woke up and I was like, everyone's like, you're going hunting. So I wake up and I'm looking, and there's a decoy. I'm like, one, two, why is there three? I didn't have three decoys. And I'm like, oh, turkey, bang. Oh, you know how many shells I had, Chris? In case they didn't have any for the shotgun I got. They were like, well, we don't have any for that. And I just, okay.
Didn't you use like a rabbit load or something? You had like a small game rabbit load or something.
It was a squirrel load or something, they said. And it was I think it was 7.5 shot on a turkey at 40 yards. Yeah. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. So, yeah.
So I make sure Chris knows about it. That's all.
So, yeah, Rick teases me. But man, air gun shotguns, they've come a long way.
Yeah.
But I have been super frustrated by the lack of innovation. So this is my call to action to all the manufacturers that I'm hoping that are watching this. It's a shotgun, guys. It's not that hard. let's get some more options out there, because turkey hunting is an absolute blast.
Yeah,
I know, Chris. You had mentioned that you the analog you drew in our previous conversation was one from the firearms industry. That, you know, hey, we have a standard cartridge, and you can make your gun fit that cartridge. But right. In the air gun shotgun world, it seems like everybody's trying to invent their own wheel, and yeah. rather than coming up with a unified solution, and maybe Bernoulli's got everybody baffled and they can't figure out how to get that much air. I don't know. I don't know what the problem is, but I do agree that you had a great idea there with how can we come up with a cartridge that does fit a lot more situations and allows the standardization and also eases the work of the air gunner that, hey, you know, I want to get a new shotgun. I don't have to go buy all new reloadable ammunition. So I agree with your take there.
Yeah.
Do you think that's possible? Do you think that's something that they could possibly work out in an industry standard way?
Well, I don't know. If you look at, you, as you can tell, I'm big into the history of firearms, right? My entire studio is like,
no,
I
love really?
The innovation of the firearm sector. And it's like, you know, when we look at like a rimless cartridge, for instance, right, it took a while for the industry to get to that point. When we had, you know, when you move from like black powder to smokeless to cartridges to rimless cartridges, it took the industry a while to, you know, to get into that sort of, okay, this is what a 45 ACP is going to look like, or this is what a 30-06 is going to be. And, and if you look at that trajectory, it took decades, if not 100 years, for some of that stuff to kind of get settled in. So we are in the golden age of air gunning right now. So do we I are. See it,
yeah.
you know, it, as a possibility someday? Absolutely. I think it's but the industry needs to get together. And I hope that like organizations like the Air Gun Sporting Association and, you know, other, you know, air gun specific associations can help with some of that. I think that would help with some of that universalizing some of the gear. You know, heck, half of my big bore air guns don't even have a freaking slud or sling studs on them because, like, you know, it's like everything's right. trying to be like really looks good, high power, but I'm always looking for like functionality. I mean, for me, a lot of times it's like I really want it to do the things that I need it to do in a hunting scenario. I don't really care how tactical I look while I'm doing it. The turkey doesn't care. The deer doesn't care. And I mean, it's a reason why sometimes, you know, hunting implements look the way they do. It's because they have a functionality to them that we need. So yeah, I think a universal cartridge around shotguns would be one of those things I'd like to see someday.
Well, I know, yeah. I know we've touched on this before where we've talked about, you know, does form follow function or does function follow form? That's always been the design argument in anything. It doesn't matter whether it's air guns, cars, or whatever. It's all the same argument. And, you know, I really like pretty wood. I love beautiful wood rifles that are, I mean, I've never seen an ugly stock by Minnelli. You know, that's just, right. that to me is the standard. You give an Italian the design job and have the Germans make it, and you've got a really good solution there. But, you know, we get a lot of clatter in our air gun world and in our air gun circles that, my God, it looks like a plumbing experiment or it's taken Tactical too far for me. And, you know, you get a lot of those remarks. Where do you guys stand on that whole, you know, what is the right solution? And obviously hunting needs to be reliable. It needs to do what it says it's going to do, and it needs to do it every time. That should be paramount. But when it comes to that nuance of the look, where do you stand?
What are you going to hold up there, Sonny? I saw you grab.
Yeah. I mean, I look at like companies like what GRS is doing, like with the wood. I mean, the first time I saw one of those, it's just that design. Yes, it's wood, but it's a modern approach.
Mm-hmm. Very much.
This is a 22 long rifle, CZ-457. And for me, it's like, yeah, I want my stuff to look good, but feel good, right? I mean, I love hunting with wood because it doesn't get cold. It just has a warmth to it as I'm holding it. companies like Wooks. I actually really like what Wooks has been doing as well. When you look at how combined like that modern tactical, you know, black gun look, but with like wood furniture to it. And I really like that. I know Air Max has been doing some stuff with that on the air gun side. I've seen some really cool FX Impacts with some wood furniture. So, I mean, to me, it is like form and function, right? I mean, I like what my guns look like, obviously, but I do feel like there are certain reasons for things. The FX DRS that's coming out has the schnobble end. You know, it has got that little cool little Italian looking. I think it's Italian. Actually, it's German. Mm-hmm. The German kind of. German.
Yeah.
And yeah, schnobel. That's German.
So, I was going to say
schnobel. It's got that end, right? And it's a reason, right? To where you want to put your hand, so that way you know where to stop on the fore end. And so, you know, it's a synthetic stock with that schnobel. But I mean, I've got 5 guns over there that were schnobel ends that are wood, and I think you know, there's purpose behind that design sometimes.
Yeah. And it's funny that you say the DRS, because we talk about functionality, we talk about old school, we talk about wood, we do all of that. That DRS is not a norm. That came right out of the middle of the cornfield on design and look.
Yeah,
because if you go to like a novice air gunner, is this a 22 long rifle or is this a 22 long rifle? And you put it next to your 4.57. It's blurring the lines in a really good way, if you ask me.
Yeah. I know for me, I went with the same with the diamond stocks. You know, you have Mad Dog stocks, but I went with diamond stocks, and mine's walnut. All because exactly what Bill said. Mm-hmm. Man, is that beautiful. Chris, you've seen that gun. And it's a Texan carbine with a diamond stock on it, and it's pure, it's walnut. It's gorgeous. Yeah. And it just makes, I don't know, it just takes me back. I'm like, man, you know, you see your father's guns and things like that with that beautiful, and Remingtons and Savage, and Remington and Winchester had some really nice walnut. And I look back and I put that on my air gun. I just look at that air gun and I'm like, yeah. To hold it, once you have the right stock on it, you're just like, oh my goodness. Yeah.
I think they shoot better with wood. Also, would you say, Rick?
For me, I don't know. I think the manufacturers, I know they do things because of pricing. They look looking at their in marketing, and then they're looking at the specs, and they're like, well, if we do this, we can sell it for this and we'll be at this price point. But how about, let me just run something by you. How about a Crossman 760? Everybody remember those? You remember those? Mm-hmm. I'm not dating myself too bad. I had something to Crossman. I said, bring it out with a wood stock. Just bring it out. And didn't they bring out their anniversary gun? 100-year anniversary.
Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that not beautiful? And how many people, I think they sold out. I said, bring back the 760 with a wood stock on it. I don't care, you know, even if it's a pump gun, right? How many people you think would even spend $150 to buy a 760 with a wood stock just to take them back in time? Yeah. And there's people out there right now that would be like, and if you had one, you would shoot it. I guarantee, even Chris with all, we still would break it out and do something with it and shoot it.
Especially if they went and put a real brass bolt on that 760. Like it was originally,
you've got right there.
Hook, line, and sinker. I'm done. You just take my money. Shut up. Take my money. I get it.
Yep. Yeah.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
That'd
be sweet. To do that. Yeah. I said, guys, there's people that would love to see that, you know, and just do that. Put that bolt on there. Exactly what you said, Bill. It'd be perfect.
Yeah.
But Woodstocks, in all reality, you got guns, you know. I know that I did a lot of work for Benjamin 10 years ago, probably 8 years ago, and the Bulldog came out, and everybody remembers the Bulldog. But before that was the Rogue. You guys remember the Rogue?
No.
The 357 Rogue. Yeah. Yeah. Look up the Rogue. Interesting concept back then. But then the Bulldog came out, and you know, people were like, they did the throwdown. So that's why I'm talking about it. You know, you had that. And then you had your Woodstock guns, you know, and definitely would love to see the manufacturers come back with Woodstocks. I think that's why some of the AEA, you know, some of the stocks that they have, you know, people grab those for, you know, FX with the GRS.
Yeah.
Beautiful Woodstocks. Change the gun. Tell me you don't love that. Yeah.
I love my Crown with the GRS, even though it's a lefty and it's a golden rabbit. I absolutely love it. It changes everything. I mean, in the firearm side, shooting wood, the gun just behaves different than in a synthetic stock, period.
Well, we all know that. Yeah. Solid. Yeah.
You know, and in the air gun side, you got that, it's a little extra heavy, but it, I think it helps.
Yeah, definitely.
I love it.
Yeah, I know. Remember the Benjamin Discovery when it came out and had that wood stock. And when you got that, it was like one of the first PCPs. I don't know if it was first, but really hitting out there with Pyramid Air and some of the places back in the day. And you got a Benjamin. I remember seeing a guy shoot an egg at like 75. I actually hit it on like the second shot. I'm like, what the heck? How the heck did he do that? Because I got a break barrel, and I'm like, all right, 10 shots, I'll get this sucker, you know? But I was like, wow, PCP, what is that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the DRS, and it was interesting when that first got announced. I mean, first off, everybody was like, oh, my gosh, that over-the-barrel reservoir, that's been done by, you know, some Chinese company a couple years ago, whatever. It was, so I started looking at it.
Yeah,
Snowpeak. And I started thinking to myself, you know, okay, air guns have been around since like what, like the 18th century. They've been around forever. And they're like, there's only so many different places where you can.
Lewis and Clark had an air gun for crying out loud.
Well, really? Tell me more.
I know something about that. I know something about that.
Come on, Bill. You use that line for people that don't know anything about air guns. Not Rick and
I. I do.
No, that's actually how I start every Department of Natural Resources presentation. Like, did you know Lewis and Clark, you know, back during the Corps of Discovery, blah, blah, blah. But the funny thing is when you look back even further, there are air guns that had reservoirs around the barrel, just like the DRS. They had reservoirs, a ball reservoir underneath the, I guess, the center point, similar to like what they're doing with the magazine well. And then obviously, like with the Air Force line, we've got buttstock bottle, you know, but then they got the Gerardoni air rifle, which Mr. Ream actually got to shoot recently. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Yes, I did.
Okay. Yeah. My jealousy meter was
pegged
through the roof. So, Rick, well, I want to hear about you shooting the Gerardoni air rifle because
that definitely
absolutely awesome.
Okay. I want to explain when I got that. And I was able to go to Air Gun Revisions. Rich Dudek had it, and he was restoring it for a museum. So it will go in a museum at some point. The one I was shooting, the gun itself is a replica of Lewis and Clark's rifle. When I say replica, these gentlemen took that gun and made the gun exactly the way it was made in 1750, I think. And what I mean, no machine parts. They did it by hand. It cost $20,000 just to do it by hand. They did it with the leather seals. They did it. I was blown away. The crown on the gun is amazing. And I thought to myself, this is a repeater. And all you do is push your thumb and shoot. Push it over, drops the ball in, slides it over, and it works perfectly. Now, it's gravity feed, if you understand. So if you're shooting downhill, it might be a little, you have to move it a little bit. But the accuracy is what blew me away. So I get my first shot, and we're shooting a 4-grain round ball, and we're probably shooting 500 feet a second. Okay. There's a sapling next to a big tree, and I look at the guy standing there, and Rich is inside, and we're getting cameras together. But I want to shoot this thing, Chris. So I'm like, hey, I'm going to shoot this. It's only, I would say that big, about an inch. And I was like, I'm going to aim dead center of that. It's 30 yards, and I squeeze the trigger. And I see the sapling go. Like, I'm like, oh, I must have nicked it. You know, I must have nicked it. Mm-mm. And this will be in the video. I actually made this video with ballistics gel, trick shots, you name it, everything's going to be in this video with this gun. We walk over to the tree, and Rich takes it, and he breaks the tree because it's already, it's in the sapling, and it's on his property. He breaks, and there's the round ball, and the reason the round ball didn't go, because the sapling's so young, it was able to catch it like a catcher's mitt and go, you know, take the power mm-hmm. out of it. And I was like, no, you didn't. Not the first shot. You can't be that accurate. No, no, no. So then I took Rich's business card and I stuck it at his thumb, went back 30 yards and split his. And I went, okay, we're going to have fun with this. And the accuracy and the firepower, no wonder Napoleon was so upset with the, I think the Austrians having this. I see why. I could have shot. Let's say 20 soda cans with that gun, then probably a minute and a half or a minute, and accurately hit everyone at different ranges. Its accuracy at 50 yards, we ended up, now I'm shooting open sights. Now, when I was aiming, I wasn't allowed to move the sights. So I had to aim opposite, you know, just yards, it would have been off about 3 or 4 inches low left. To get dead center, but the group, I think, Chris, wasn't the group something like
yeah, it was crazy.
Probably he was 2 inches.
Yeah, he was sending me like photos, calling me while it was all happening, and I was just blown away by the precision of that thing for something that technology that's that old. It was absolutely crazy.
Here's what really blew me away. So I have a signature shot I do on every air gun I get. It tells me, is this gun? Can I take it to this level? I always lay a playing card on top of a balloon. Now, with a gun that caliber of that time era, can I shoot a playing card off of a balloon at 25 yards? We didn't do 50 because open sights, I'm getting older to see these wearing these. So anyway, I shoot the first shot over the top, shoot, and I'm cheating because I call it, you know, walking it in. But then the second shot, the card and actually puts a mark on it, but doesn't take it off. It just touches it. Would you believe I was able to move it another fraction of an inch and cut the card? Totally blasted it, and it cut it without popping the balloon. I looked over at Rich and I said, I can't believe it was that accurate. It actually did what I asked it to do. And I thought, wow, these guys were way ahead. But the whole point is, like you said, Chris, we go back in time and look at these guns. Yeah, we're not reinventing the wheel, but we kind of are, you know, in a way. For the air reservoirs in the stock.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, when DRS was announced, I mean, everybody was like, you know, and I actually did some research. I can't remember the name of the air gun, but there was another over-the-barrel reservoir from the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So it really becomes a unique challenge of how these manufacturers are figuring out both where to put the main fill source reservoir and then also the plenum. And then how FX basically put it into that magazine well, I think is absolutely genius. I mean, when you look at that, the DRS Pro, and I put it side by side with the Bagara MDT chassis. When you look at those two pictures side by side, that length of that magazine and the DRS Pro, it looks like a 10-round magazine out of a Bagara in an MDT chassis. And I think a lot of people, there was some comments online in the forums of like, oh my gosh, it looks like a firearm. They're going to regulate. I mean, guys, that genie is out of the bottle, right? We've got big bore air guns now that are producing over 1,000+ foot pounds of energy. So having something that looks like a firearm, to me, what does that do? Like, what's the purpose of that? And honestly, as we look at people that are in like precision shooting and, you know, talk with, you know, Josh from Pursuit of Accuracy and some other guys that are really deep into that stuff, like Warren, right, from Air Shootists, these guys that absolutely love that precision stuff, that the balance of these air guns, it's a purpose, right? It's not just to make it look like a firearm, be cool. There's purpose to it, right? Getting that balance point just right and being able to stick the muzzle of your air gun through a barricade and not have it, you know, clank into the, I mean, you know, my FX impact's probably like that big trying to get that
right
window. That's why I like, you know, the Panthera, the reason why they had that form factor, but the DRS Pro is going to even be a better kind of solution to that. I am super excited. Rick, I think you and I are getting our DRS classics tomorrow. I think they're actually.
I think you're right.
In our, I've been tracking all day long. Actually, I'm gonna see my DRS classic, and I'm hoping of mine gets here to Michigan before Rick gets his in Pennsylvania. I'm calling. Calling in sick. So, work if you're watching this. I'm not feeling
it. He's already sick.
Look at me. Yeah. I look horrible. I need to call in sick, bro.
You cannot go to work, young man.
It is. I have been so excited about that thing because it just looks so cool. That over the barrel, you know, reservoirs looks awesome. And what I'm most excited about it is I'm actually going to completely tear it apart after I do my first review video, because I want to look at that plenum. I want to look at like how they figured out to get that fill source around the barrel. So Frederick, Johan, if you're watching, I am sorry. I'm going to tear that thing apart. I want to look at that thing, but.
And he will.
I will, and I will mess some stuff up, but I'm interested of like how upgradable and modifiable that thing is. I don't know if you saw that, Rick, but there's a competition trigger option for that thing.
I heard,
competition trigger option.
I thought there was something with the valve too. I thought they, they had some
super efficient valve. I mean, Johan had to do a lot of stuff to that gun to get it to where it's at. So anyway, I'm super excited. Mine should be here tomorrow or the next day, but I hope mine gets before Rick's does.
I had
the privilege. It probably will.
I had the privilege of looking at that gun at IWA with Johan. Mm-hmm. He gave me an absolutely wonderful interview, which it'll appear somewhere near when this podcast actually airs. Mm-hmm. So you'll be able to see that video as well. But the thing that really jazzed me about that, and this is something that I know I tend to see things that other people don't see because I just look at things differently. But for me, being able to, you know, the firearms industry has had years of development and products and things out there to support the firearms world. But a lot of that stuff does not translate well over to air guns. If you have a scabbard and you have a scabbard for a normal hunting rifle, most of your air guns will not fit it because that bottle is just way too big. It's way too low and it will not fit in a typical scabbard. So for me, looking at the DRS, I'm like, oh my God, any scabbard for the firearm world, that gives me a lot more utility. I can throw it on the quad. I can throw it on my e-bike. I can get out in the woods with this in a way that other air guns kind of tend to fight me on. So that's really what jazzed me about that thing.
That's cool.
Chris, is, you know, here in PA, you know, we do 177 and 22. And of course the one that we got coming is 22.
Yeah.
I'm thinking that's the perfect squirrel gun, the way it feels, you know, the way it's going to feel. I don't have it yet, Chris. So yeah, but I'm looking at what's gave it away. But, I'm excited for it, you know, and I think the 522 is what I got coming.
Yeah.
And I'm looking forward to giving that a try and seeing how that works out. And I'll be setting it up. And of course, all week long, I was thinking, well, what on this? What optic did I put on this? And I think I'm hoping Chris doesn't put the same one on, but I think he's going to.
Probably. Which one do you put on?
Yeah. You're looking at HD.
Yes. HD's perfect for it, man.
Yeah. Absolutely. See, I'm a prison guy.
You put on the HD, and I'm going to put on I'll do like the HDLR, you do the HD, or the 5-30 immersive. But, I mean, it's not going to be a long-range gun. You know, it's a 50-yard, which is really cool. Well, one of the little sidebar debates I got in with somebody was like, well, yeah, but it's got that micro magazine. It doesn't have a high shot capacity. And that over barrel reservoir, you only get like, you know, a dozen shots plus. Right. And I made the analogy of like, whenever I go out with my 22 long rifle, the CZ457 that I just held up, this is what I'm bringing out to the field is like probably a couple of these guys, right? A couple 10 round magazines for 22 long rifle. If it's a good day, it is a good day. In the squirrel hunting woods or small game, if I burn through all one magazine, that's a good day. So
one mag, right?
I mean, there's a difference between hunting and pesting, right? And Rick, Rick and I, we've gone done the prairie dog thing out in Utah with Justin, which is absolutely awesome. And trust me, you are bringing, you better bring like a boatload of ammo when you do that.
Yeah.
But for hunting with the DRS Classic, like using the 22 long rifle example, I'm not going to the woods with a 400 round CCI like value pack.
Right.
So yeah. To me, those mini mags and having a dozen shots to go rabbit hunting, squirrel hunting, you know, that's what else do you need? Right. I mean, I love my impact, but I love my impact for a competition gun where I need to take a ton of sighters. I don't like doing magazine changes. Or if I, you know, I went out to Utah and we did the prairie dog thing where we probably waxed hundreds of them. Picking the right tool for the job, I guess, is my point. Yeah.
Yeah. My primary job of my impact here on my farm, and it's just an old Mark II and 30 cal, is for coyote dispatch. And honestly, if I take two shots with that on a night hunt for a coyote, that's an amazing night.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not going to get many more than that because they're wily. He got his name for a reason. Wily Coyote was the way he was for a reason, because that's the way that animal is. And, you know, I don't know. I've never been all that mag crazy, although I do love what Maple has done with some of their magazine designs for other guns and expanding them in a way that makes sense. But, you know, beyond that, I'm not the guy who's going to have that big tractor belt fed magazine contraption hanging out of the side of my gun. I'm going to snap it off. I'll be the guy who cooks that on a branch going through the woods. And absolutely not only ruins the magazine, but probably takes out the gun as well. So I want it small. I want it compact. So did you guys get your DRSs with wood stocks?
Synthetic first. Yeah.
Synthetic both. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm excited. I mean, love the MDT chassis it is awesome. I don't know if you've ever actually had a chance to touch or use or shoulder an MDT chassis. They are pretty high level. They are pretty good, but I am excited about to see what other third party manufacturers might come out with different chassis options, because I mean, MDT, it looks great. You know, there's a price point obviously with those chassis, but I'd like to see. It's what I love about whenever FX comes out with new things. I love seeing all the third party development that's happening with Air Marksman and Saber Tactical, and everybody's, you know, developing new magazines. You know, Orion's magazine, Orion Iguana Hunters magazines are absolutely awesome. You know, and I just think, you know, love or hate FX, you have to give them credit that they actually have created something in the air gun industry that has created a lot of third party like opportunities for people to develop different cool things around it. And it's just, I mean, to me, that's super exciting, is that there's so much excitement around, you know, what a brand is and then what a brand can become as you modify. And do you need the modifications? No, you don't need it. Nope. But dude, I got a Toyota Tacoma sitting in my driveway that I dropped another 10 grand on it the day I bought it, because I wanted more stuff for it, right? I wanted bigger tires, racks on the back and lights and all that stuff. It's just like, we are all dudes and gals that love to you know, basically modify our stuff. I love the fact that there's so much innovation around what FX is doing, and it's super exciting.
Make it your own.
Yep. You know, guys, we did skip something at the top of the conversation. That was about the whole, I think we zoomed right past it, was about kind of like burying the lead about Wisconsin, you know?
Absolutely. And we've got to take the opportunity to also call out the honor roll for some of our friends in the air gun industry that didn't get a lot of love with that announcement. But do tell us, Chris, bring us up to speed. Yeah. Tell us what's going on with air gunning in Wisconsin.
So we've talked a lot in this conversation about a lot of the advocacy work that Rick and I have been doing. He's been Pennsylvania, me here in the Midwest. But man, Wisconsin got announced, I think it was yesterday or day before yesterday, that it is now big game legal in the state of Wisconsin. And you have no idea. I mean, I love Michigan, but I have been dying to get over to Wisconsin to hunt some deer and turkeys and other things over there. So they finally got it across the finish line.
And you were in this fight. You were in this fight for those rights.
Absolutely. So, I mean, not just me, but there are people like PJ Clark from Wisconsin Air Gunners who now works for Sabre Tactical and Don EFL. He doesn't live in Wisconsin anymore, but he fought for years to try his best. There are, I know, probably a half a dozen air gunners that showed up, gave public comment to the, I think it's called the Conservation something or another, whatever they're, here in Michigan, we have the National Resources Commission, but in Wisconsin, they have their body, their legislative body that recommends hunting regulations. And they had people showing up, giving public comment, submitting proposals. And this has been going on for half of a decade, if not more, in the state of Wisconsin. So the Air Gun Sporting Association, huge shout out to Mitch King, his team. And they had Keith, who was actually a retired wildlife agency official, help work with Mitch to get that across the finish line. But I just wanted to say on behalf of all the rest of us air gunners, thank you guys to living in Wisconsin or that hunt in Wisconsin that just made your voices heard, because that's what it takes, right? You got to show up. You got to show up at these public, these opportunities where if your wildlife agency allows for a public comment period, do not sleep on that, because that is how change gets made. And you got to show up, make your comment. But I also really, you know, get with the Air Gun Sporting Association and get those common talking points, because there are certain things that I've learned. I've made mistakes in the past as I've done the advocacy work where there are certain things you should not bring. Like, don't bring up air gun arrows first. I will tell you that. Don't ever bring that up first, because that
Don't lead off with that.
So getting with the Air Gun Sporting Association and getting those common talking points, talk to, you know, people that have been doing advocacy work like PJ Clark and Rick and myself, just what works, what doesn't, you know, but the idea is like just making your voice heard. And they did it in Wisconsin, and I'm going to be deer hunting this year. And I think it's November 18th, I think, is their opening day. And I hope to get the first deer down with an air gun. I don't think that's probably going to happen, but I mean, I'll be over there. And just anyway, super proud of the air gun industry for getting that done. And yeah, Wisconsin is an awesome state. I mean,
their that's awesome.
It's crazy. Huge deer too. So
that's Rick, exciting. Yep. Where are you at with your fight in Pennsylvania?
Mm-hmm.
Well, right now I know that Ryan and I were looking to see when our next meeting was going to be with them. So I'd have to ask Ryan, but what we're going to try and do is where we get the game commission out, Chris, like we did before. And we're going to introduce them again to things and foot pounds, but now there's more videos. There's more things to talk about, more things to show. And then there's also new people in PA and people we met with previous years. So things have changed, and it sounds like it's more pro air gun. Stay tuned. We're in for another where Ryan, I know, is setting something up. So we're going to have another talk with
those
them.
Those new people in Pennsylvania, Rick, they're not all from New Jersey, are they?
No, because them were not allowed to have slingshots. So just in case you were wondering. Yeah.
Got it.
But that's kind of where we're at with that. We're going to have another bout and we'll show them what we got. So, and you know what? It's education, like the new people that should help out. And what I mean by that, there was some people that were there that were like tight fisted. Would not budge even after conversations. So,
wow. Oh, well. Change is hard, but yeah, definitely. Congrats on all the hard work. Definitely.
Yeah. Kudos.
We'll get there. It'll happen.
And for those that don't know the inside story, yesterday I had my phone and I was looking at my Google updates, and there I see a picture of Chris the Turek. With an air gun and the announcement that Wisconsin just passed 6 bills, I think, all at once that all impact air gun hunting in Wisconsin. And I thought, wow, how ironic is it that I have have an interview with this guy the very next day. Mm-hmm. And here he is, the poster boy for air gun hunting in Wisconsin.
Yeah, there's only, yeah, I would not call it, again, all the credit goes to Mitch and the ASA, you know, the grassroots stuff that the Wisconsin, those cheeseheads over there in Wisconsin, they got it done. I mean, honestly, that photo that you saw, that was like the lead story from, I think it was from a Wisconsin newspaper, and I met those guys at the, it was like the some type of a Midwest Outdoor Writers Conference, and so we, FX had actually sponsored a range day. And we were showing the FX Impact 35 Cal, I think that at that time. So it was interesting because, like, we were showing them with the FX 35, and I'm holding, you know, MOA groups at 100 with that. And they're like, wow, like, that's so powerful. I'm like, yeah, super precise. But guess what? There's big bore air guns over here that are like three times as powerful as that.
Right.
And they were blown away. So that's where that photo was from that range day with that writers group. And, but yeah, just, Air Gun Sporting Association and all those Wisconsin guys, they got it through. They got it across the finish line. And I am a hunting air gun tourist. Make sure I'm saying that right. I'm a tourist, not a terrorist. Tourist.
Yeah.
That I travel with my air guns. And now that I know that Wisconsin's legal, I will be taking my vacation time and money to chase some of their game animals. And I think a lot of the agencies that are on the fence on this is like, it creates good tourism for your state.
Uh-huh. When you first pass rate. More
good hunting regulations like this. So
first rate. Well, guys, we are just about out of time for this episode, but I think, you know, we would love to have you guys on again in 2024, because I think there's so much we haven't even scratched the surface of.
Yeah.
But we usually do a little drill with our guests. We ask, what is the one thing you want to pass on to our readers and listeners and viewers? What do you want to say to them? And it doesn't have to be air gun related. I know Rick had fun with this when we interviewed him at RMAC. What is it that you want to, we'll give it to Rick first. Rick, what do you want to pass along?
Well, I will pertain at this time to air guns. You know, I was just telling somebody yesterday, they're like, why? First time air gunner. He says, why do you love air guns? I said, well, the world gets busy. Time, life gets busy. Everything's always moving. You're doing so much. And you got responsibilities everywhere. But when I was 12 and I walked out with that box that carried my pellets and had my bologna and cheese sandwich with my Doritos and my high C apricot drink, and I would go sit down in a field or a meadow and feel the sun on my face, shooting my 10-pump 2200, life just was beautiful right there in that moment. And that's why I shoot air guns, for fun. I really do it for fun. And it takes me back to when I was 12.
That is beautiful. Thank you, Rick. Chris, to you.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to actually kind of take what Rick just said and kind of expand upon it a little bit. You know, the community of air gunning is what I love the most. I mean, the friendships that I've created in this community. I talk a lot about my military service. Rick's a veteran too. And I truly believe that, like, the connections that we make in this air gunner community are as strong. And it's just like, you know, I share things that don't even have to do with air gunning. I talk to Rick about stuff. I talk to PJ stuff, Keith and Norm, and a lot of different guys about this. And I think getting into air gunning, and, you know, we get online, you get on the online forums, you get in some of these Facebook groups, and there's just a lot of, you know, chatter and people arguing about twist rates and whatever the argument of.
Pellets are better than slugs. No, slugs.
Yeah. No, it's over 1,000 feet per second, you'll break the space-time continuum. Like, just
that's right.
Stupid stuff, right? Just try to keep it fun. You know, guys, when you're in an online forum, and I have to hold myself accountable here because I have gotten in some pissing matches with people over different things a lot of times, but the community that we are part of, we are all passionate air gunners, and I think the friendships that are created, I just, my call to action to everybody that's listening to this, try to make it a goal this year to get to one of the major shooting competitions. I don't care if it's East Air Gun Classic, Rocky Mountain Air Gun Challenge, Pyramid Cup, or EBR. Try to come to the one of the major ones, because getting a chance to meet the manufacturers and, you know, guys like Rick and I and all the other people in our community, guys like Bill and Patrick, all y'all, it's literally the best community of hobbyist sportsmen I have ever been in. So that's my call to action.
Agreed. Agreed. Yeah. Wonderful people. I mean, professional people. Just one thing, Chris, you remember at events, somebody's gun goes down. You're competing for $20,000 and hands a gun to somebody. You know, yeah. You're just like, and then that guy competes with that gun and the other guy didn't even care. But in other shooting disciplines I've seen, you know, it's been different. So,
yeah. And Bill, I know we got to wrap, but I'm just going to end with this. Seriously, like reach out to Rick's got a lot of guns. I've got a lot of guns. If you're going to be at a shooting competition and you just don't have something, take your pick. I will bring any one of my guns to, you know, to work with you. And I've actually have a standing offer. If you win with that gun, you're going to be able to keep it because Rick and I are blessed. We get sponsors. Yeah. We are able to test these things. But I don't ever want somebody to think that they're not going to come to a shooting competition because they're you do need to practice. I mean, you gotta get out there and practice. But I made a post the other day. The best way to practice is to, you know, practice first, but competing, and you're going to learn a lot of lessons during competition. So just get out there and
we'll help each other.
Yep. Yeah, we're there to help.
I'm going to set it better myself. So with that, there's the Northeast Airgun Classic that Chris was talking about. That's April 17th through the 21st. Just go to the NortheastAirGunClassic.com. You don't even have to compete. Yep. You get to see air gunners and get to see the culture firsthand and see what it's all about and get to meet people at face value that we are all real, just humans. And then after that, you got RMAT coming up, which is June 19th, I think, through the 23rd. Mm-hmm. I know for a fact Bill and I will be there, so make sure you stop and see us. And I know Chris and Rick will be there. Also, all those that are listening on the Apple Podcast, please give us 5 stars, leave comments, and we will share them with Rick and Chris if you have a question for them, and we'll get you an answer, or they can be contacted through their respectful YouTube channels. Shooter 1721 for Rick Rem. And Up North Air Gunner for Chris Turek. And I know for a fact that they respond back. Be patient. We are all busy people. But they will get back to you. All of those that did the ballast doll giveaway, we'll be pulling that here soon. So be patient. And I can't wait because we're giving away 6 cleaning kits, guys, to air gun listeners of the podcast. So
awesome.
With that, Bill, you got any final words?
I'm gonna bow out of this game, Patrick, because we've already had these guys kind of upstage us for anything that we were gonna add. But I will just say, hey, be a light in the darkness for everyone around you because it matters, especially in these trying times.
And like always, stay geeky. I can't give that up. I had children coming up to me saying, "Stay geeky." I love it.
Oh, right.
Good job, guys. This is fun.